Okay, welcome to our podcast. My name is Calvin Tompkins. I'm Assistant Medical Director with Mission Health Partners, and we are joined today by Dr. Bruce Bako from the Mission Children's Sleep Disorder Clinic. Thanks for joining us.
Well, happy to. It's a pleasure.
Great. So the purpose of this podcast is to provide some context for the co-management guide, which is located on the Mission Children's toolbox online, and provides a strategy for both referral criteria to the sleep disorder clinic, but then also endpoints and just expectations that you can communicate to parents. So maybe we can start off by asking for a summary of the sleep disorder clinic.
Well, we've been working pretty hard over the last couple of years to really try and put together a comprehensive pediatric sleep program. We're fortunate because we have a very well-equipped and well-staffed sleep lab admission with people who are child-friendly and rooms that are child-friendly and a dedicated pediatric component. And they're generally able to do really remarkably good studies, even in younger children that you'd expect it may be quite a challenge with on occasion. So they do a great job, and we're trying to really make services more available. It's interesting though, because younger children, you know, particularly under 10 to 12, who aren't sleeping or getting restful sleep like they should at night, will often not have a lot of daytime sleepiness or fatigue. They'll actually go to the other extreme, and the main presenting complaints will be, you know, daytime inattention or behavioral problems or lack of focus or a lot of acting out during the day at school often prompts an evaluation too. That, you know, that can relate to, you know, children who are being evaluated and treated for attention deficit disorder or other school-related complaints. But that thought should also arise too.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, we in the primary care space, we're evaluating behavior complaints as well as attention and school performance, and so I see a sleep disorder evaluation as a part of that workup.
Yeah, when a question comes up, it definitely should be. And I guess I got a little bit ahead of myself, but you know, among the people who have obesity-related obstruction, you know, that's kind of a classical picture. You know, and a lot of those children will have other comorbidities that can relate and prompt suspicion for obstruction-related issues, such as, you know, hypertension or diabetes or hyperlipidemia or any of those things kind of travel with OSAS, and it really deserves a pretty comprehensive look if there's concern about that.
With a thought being that if you can mediate the obstruction, that some of those other entities can you can make some headway.
Definitely. I mean, it's pretty clear cut that, you know, if a child does have horrible obstruction-related breathing problems at night, and they also have obesity or diabetes or hypertension, if you get the OSAS treated and managed adequately, the rest can go a whole lot better. I mean, it can actually allow people who are obese to achieve significant weight control and weight reduction if they sleep better at night. They're more active during the day, and the hormones that regulate dietary intake and appetite function more appropriately once the obstruction is treated.
Well, we, in the middle of a obesity epidemic, we are certainly hard at work and with our population to mitigate those issues. So there may be a bigger role for evaluating sleep disorders in that setting. Talk to us a little bit about trisomy 21 and the current recommendations there.
Well, you know, obviously obesity is only one cause of obstruction that can occur at night. Children who have Down syndrome, for a number of reasons, are very predisposed to have obstructive sleep apnea. That relates to low muscle tone, macroglossia. They have large tongues relative to their oral cavity size. They tend to have larger neck circumferences. They tend to obstruct easily. So there are recommendations out there that suggest that most of those children should have an overnight polysomnogram by the time they're 4 years of age, which is sometimes difficult, but it often goes much better than you'd expect in that age group. They do a great job in the sleep lab, know, sometimes we have to put that off until 5 or 6 years of age because it goes more easy at that point. But that being said, there's also probably an equal number of situations where if there are obvious clues that there's significant difficulty at night, you know, it may be appropriate to do an overnight study earlier than 4 years of age, which is obviously sometimes a challenge. But, you know, if the thought comes up, it's probably best to look because it can, you know, if you have significant obstruction-related breathing trouble during the night, it can cause a whole slew of really undesirable things to happen. So it's important to recognize it early. You know, the children with Downs, a lot of them have related heart disease and pulmonary hypertension or related pulmonary abnormalities, that if you really get hypoxic or obstruct during the night, all of that goes a whole lot worse. So it's very important to recognize this and treat it as early as you can, which is why those recommendations are in place. You know, and we mentioned earlier, there are also a wide variety of other children who have other reasons to have obstruction during the night. Neuromuscular processes are probably the top of that list. And children who have, muscular dystrophy or spinal muscular atrophy or cerebral palsy or any sort of ill-defined progressive neuromuscular disorder, they're at high risk to have ventilation and obstruction issues during the night and often deserve to have an overnight study done either for screening purposes or if the question comes up pretty early on.
And I gather another bucket is the those patients who may have narcolepsy or hypersomnolence.
Right. You know, that's another broad category of sleep disorders, and it, you know, those are more typically seen in adults. But you know, the important issue or concern there is, you know, things like narcolepsy can be genetically based, and they are, you're born with it, and it starts causing trouble earlier in life than adulthood. The most frequent presenting complaint for narcolepsy, surprisingly, is insomnia, and it often doesn't get picked up until you're in your 20s or 30s, but it starts in the teenage years and even earlier in some situations. So, you know, like we were talking about before, if you're faced with a child, particularly who's, you know, under 10 or 12 years of age, who's overly sleepy and falls asleep frequently during the day at school, who gets apparently adequate sleep at night, that's not a normal situation, and that should prompt, you know, more detailed evaluation. There are children who don't have narcolepsy, who have hypersomnolence disorders, and that by definition is just children who are sleepy despite adequate sleep at night. And given the choice, some of those children will sleep for 14 and 16 and 18 hours a day if you let them, even though they get appropriate sleep at night. And there's ways you can treat that with various medications and other, you know, behaviorally based modalities that can be very helpful and really improve their school performance as well.
Okay, great. And then we discussed behavioral issues and attention deficits. Maybe we could just get touch briefly on anxiety or depression and its interplay with poor sleep.
All right. Well, you know, it's interesting because it's hard sometimes to know if the anxiety and depression are causing the poor sleep at night, or if the poor sleep at night is causing the anxiety and depression, and it can certainly go both ways. You know, children who are very depressed, and adults for that matter as well, you know, it seems that they either don't sleep at all or that they sleep continuously, and it can present either way. So, you know, it's always important to consider the mental health related side issues that can relate to sleep and lack of sleep. And that's very important. That's a part of what we try and accomplish with our evaluations as well. And we have psychiatric and psychological support to help with that. But, you know, insomnia, there are disorders like insomnia and restless leg syndrome or periodic limb movement disorder that don't necessarily require an overnight study to sort that out. You know, sleep studies are only a component, one aspect of our evaluation and treatment. You know, some of this relates to, you know, just like anything else we deal with in pediatrics, with good history and good physical exam and recognition and treatment. But it doesn't all require necessarily an overnight study to sort out these issues.
Okay. And then just to be completely clear with regards to concerns for obstructive sleep apnea, if in with with the physical exam findings of tonsillar hypertrophy, overt tonsillar hypertrophy, and symptoms of poor sleep, what's the algorithm for getting a sleep study versus a consult versus referring to ear, nose, and throat?
You know, this question's been coming up a lot more lately, and we've been trying to facilitate the process to allow appropriate things to happen easier. I guess the way I would simplify this in my mind to make it pretty clear cut, you know, if a child who's 6 years of age or under has pretty impressive tonsil hypertrophy and clearly has obstructive symptoms at night, even that being the case, most ENT specialists aren't going to be willing to go ahead and deal with that surgically unless they have some sort of objective indication that they need to. So the easiest thing to do is to go ahead and get an overnight study in that group of children. If it shows significant obstructive problems, then they need to go see the ear, nose, and throat folks with that in hand, and they'll likely go ahead and do an adenotonsillectomy, and 80% of the time that'll fix their problem. You know, if that occurs and their symptoms resolve, we don't necessarily need to see those people afterwards, even if we've seen them before. I mean, 80% of the time symptoms clear substantially or completely after surgery. Now, if a child's over six and has, you know, obviously obstructive tonsils on exam and has a history that makes you wonder about obstruction during the night and sleep-related problems, I would probably just go ahead and refer that child on to the ENT specialist and see what they think. Odds are they'll go ahead and intervene and help with that. On the other hand, they may feel that they would be more comfortable or it would be appropriate to go ahead with an overnight study. And we're trying to arrange the situation so either they can order an overnight study or the primary care doctor can order that study, and we can interpret it and get the results to them without necessarily having to evaluate them ahead of the fact.
Okay, great. Anything else you wanted to add?
I think we covered it pretty well.
Yeah, I think we did. I want to thank you for spending some time with us and recording this twice due to my own recording skills.
Technology is a burdensome thing.
But I appreciate you dropping by today.
No problem at all. Appreciate the opportunity.